You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter. I get to say a bright, beautiful, sunny, no, not sunny, but bright day. It's very pretty out there. And there's no rain, but it's kind of overcast. It was foggy this morning.
We have had some very dense ground fogs the last few days here in the Sacramento Valley, at least on our side of the valley. Tule fogs, as we call them in our area, because this was once Tule Marsh. And these fogs formed over the Tule Marshes as the temperature dropped and water vapor condenses out to suspended water droplets, and that is fog. If you want to know what fog technically is and look in Wikipedia, it is a visible aerosol consisting of tiny water droplets or ice crystals, not common here, suspended in the air near the Earth's surface, can be considered a type of low-lying cloud. Indeed, fog is cloud at ground level. What we get here in the Sacramento Valley is a really dense low-lying fog that we call ground fog or tule fog.
So is the water that is making the fog, is that coming up from the ground or off the water, or is it coming down from the air
It's water vapor in the air, and you can't see it until the temperature gets low enough for it to become visible droplets that are suspended in the air. So it's a cloud, just like the clouds above you. And it was that water vapor was there, but at higher temperature, it's in the form of gas. At lower temperature, it's in the form of suspended water particles, water droplets.
So when I'm driving around and I drive from my house and I go out through a county road to get over to the grocery store, the tule fog, mm-hmm. seems to be hovering above fields mm-hmm. rather than being in town.
Because an open field loses heat more quickly than other surfaces. So it's simply a function of the localized temperature, and that can make it rather dangerous. If you move to Sacramento Valley, if you're here years ago, 40, 50 years ago, when both of us moved here, this kind of fog was routine from late November into early to mid-January, and can happen before and after that, but that was the usual period. Right around the holidays, especially, fog particles, water particles, will form around dust particles or other things that are suspended in the air. So very fine dust can be suspended in the air. That can form a nucleus for fog, water droplets, to form. The dust has gone away, and the smoke has gone away. Smoke contains particles to a significant degree compared to when we first moved here. So it is well known, has been established, that the incidences of fog have dropped dramatically in the Sacramento Valley. Over one 30-year period, it was a significant percentage of reduction in the number of foggy days. People who moved here in the 60s and 70s remember long periods, around Christmas in particular, when it was very dangerous to drive here. The ground fog, the tule fogs, the reason they're dangerous is exactly what you're describing. You can be zipping along on Pedrick Road and it's clear as can be, and you turn right on Seavers and suddenly your visibility is 30 feet. And so you better slow down and drive accordingly. And literally 15 feet above that, yeah. Open and clear. Going around the next corner, open and clear. And so people who are new to the area drive very rapidly and then suddenly find themselves in very dense fog. And there have been some spectacular accidents in the area when this occurs. So I should back up here. Lois and I are recording this show on November 26, 2025. 39 years ago, I drove to the hospital in a ground fog and watched my daughter get born. Happy birthday. And it was in a ground fog, which meant that we were zipping along at 60 miles an hour with mom in labor in the passenger seat. And then all of a sudden we'd hit the fog and I'd drop down to 20, 25, 30 miles an hour. And we went a significant portion of the drive between Dixon and Woodland at about 30 miles an hour with a person in labor. We got there in time. Everything went well. Happy birthday to my kid 39 years later. But it was that kind of fog. It's kind of scary when that happens. It would be at moments, it would be above us. There'd be a ceiling of fog and the highway would be clear. And then next mile down, you were in the fog and you could only see like two car lengths ahead of you. So we're having that kind of fog. Now, if it scares you, I'm sorry, but it's quite beautiful. And one thing that we really appreciate about it, this is really important for the dormancy of fruit trees. We had, until a week ago, zero chilling hours to date. Zero. Yeah, we talked a lot about chilling hours a couple of shows ago. Well, I went back. This is lower start to the chilling hours year than we've had in 6 years. That's as far back as I went. We're catching up very rapidly because remember, chilling hours by the old model, temperature is 32 to 45 degrees. We had not been below 45 degrees for most of the first part of November. What we had was one Pacific storm after another, not giving us a lot of rain, but keeping the warmer air trapped in, and it was about 50 degrees. And so we weren't getting down to the traditional 32 to 45 degree chilling hour. This fog is holding us at about 45 degrees now for several hours each day. So we are catching up on chilling hours. Chilling portions, the newer model we've talked about a little bit, which acknowledges that chilling is still occurring up to 50 or 55 degrees. The chilling portions model is behind, but not dramatically behind. The chilling hours model was way behind. Master Gardener came in, we were chatting about it, and it was zero. I mean, zero a week ago. And now we're beginning to catch up. What we really count on for the dormancy of the deciduous stone fruits and apples and things like that is temperatures below 45 degrees, below 50 degrees for a number of hours each night and into the daytime. And when we get this kind of fog, we get that. So uncomfortable as it may be for us, it's actually great for the fruit trees. They're getting the chilling they need. They're going into that dormancy properly. This coming week, we're going to have more of it. Basically, the weather is going to be 56 to 58 degrees high temperatures and 40 to 41 degrees low temperatures for the next 5 days. We actually get below 40, I think, on Monday night, where it'll be 39 degrees. They're talking about patchy fog between about 8 a.m. and 11 a.m. every day of the next 5 or 6, and then burning off by early afternoon, getting up into the 50s. So it'll be very pretty. It's going to be calm. I don't see any real wind in the forecast whatsoever in the next week. Wind tends to clear out the fog, tends to open things up. If we do get a north wind, if it does clear it all out, and we go into the evening, night temperature starting in the, at sunset, starting in the mid-40s, possibility of frost that night. So just be aware of that since we haven't actually had a frost yet as well. But we've got basically temperatures into the mid to upper 50s, low temperatures 39 to 40 degrees for the next week. Rainfall totals to date, let's see here. 3.2 inches of rain in November, 1.66 inches in October. So we're at 4.9 inches of rain to date, which is just about average. We're doing well as far as rainfall goes. And we've been on the low end actually locally because all the rainstorms that have come in have gone around us. Basically, we got less than almost every other weather station around us. So the reservoirs are in pretty good shape. Snowpack is beginning to build. And more importantly, for local gardeners, the soil is soft and nice and loose for digging holes to plant things. Great weather for planting and perfect for pulling weeds, which I would suggest you do because someone brought in a sample of the weed and he said, "What is this?" And I said, "That's bed straw." Okay.
Yep.
You
And it's
remember?
up.
It's
It's
up.
up.
His is 6 inches. It's about, I'd say, a month ahead of usual in terms of its growth rate so far. And it breaks off really easily right now. And you just take a hoe or even just step on the thing, you'll probably break it off. If you don't do that, this is that one that sticks to you. People are calling it Velcro weed. If you had a lot of it last year, go to those spots. Those seedlings are quite recognizable. Chop them, hoe them, cover them with a tarp, whatever is easier for you. Just take action now.
So, the bed straw dance is a fun thing. You take it, you see it. It's on the ground. It's not in anything. It's just there. So you step on it and twist.
Yeah, there you go.
That takes care of it, and you don't even have to pick them up. They'll just disintegrate and go away. They won't resprout from the broken off top part.
Yeah, I'm thinking we need some kind of music to go along with that. So let's come up with some kind of good stomp and buck music that'll get you out there stomping on your bed straw.
Twist. It's a twist.
There you go. Go out and stomp on the bed straw.
Do we have any events that you wanted to talk about or any
No,
announcements or anything?
there's
I
no
mean, it's
event.
winter, there's not much happening.
No, we wanted to mention a resource since we don't have any events per se, but the Master Gardeners are always busy. And the Master Gardeners here at Davis have a blog that you probably aren't aware of. And I became more aware of it because I conferred with the author of a couple of one of the recent articles, and now I have found it on here. It's called The Savvy Sage. The Savvy Sage. You get to this by going to ucanr.edu. You should have that bookmarked already.
In the front
ucanr.edu.
page, there it is.
All the way up on the
Right
top,
there.
you'll see it says blogs. Click on blogs. You can go to Yolo County and you can find the Savvy Sage. And this is written, the most recent articles are written by Peg Smith, who's a very active garden volunteer here in Davis. She's at the, let's see, the Central Park Gardens. You'll see her there a lot. And she writes for the Master Gardeners as well. And this particular most recent one is December Garden Tips and Vegetable Planting Guide, just posted November 24th. So I recommend that, commend that to you.
And savvy is spelled SAVVY.
Yes, thank you. So this is The Savvy Sage, great blog at ucanr.edu. Check it out. Lots of comments here about winter habitat gardening and a lot of other great topics there as well.
Okay. John, thank you, John. John wrote to us and said, "Hi, Lois and Don. A few shows ago, Don mentioned using the old style Christmas incandescent lights to add heat to frost tender plants. Well, I planted a small golden medallion tree for someone a couple months ago, and it is small.
Right.
I want it to not die. I want it to do well this winter. So I built a wood frame and covered five sides with frost cloth and strung incandescent Christmas lights on the inside." And he sent us a picture. It is so beautiful. "I tested the box when it was 48 degrees outside and it measured 64 degrees inside the box with the lights on." That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
"During the day with the lights off, it was 65 outside and 84 inside the box with just the sun. I've attached pictures of the box. I have a question. I hope you can help. Would you suggest I leave this box over the plant all day, or is it better or necessary to remove it during the day and just have it
Okay,
on at night?"
we'll take these one at a time. I get this question about frost blanket as well. The frost blanket materials that people are using now do allow light to penetrate and they're lightweight. So it's not as crucial to remove them as it would be if you would say put a blanket or a sheet over the plant. But in any event, I do get concerned about just the lack of air movement and the amount of moisture built up around the leaves and the fact that you could get some mold or something growing on the leaves. If you get a bacterial situation where there's any kind of necrosis, it could spread on the leaf. So I would take it off every so often. And if it's a sunny day, that would be a great day to do it because that would get, some more sunlight on the leaves, more air movement in there. So you don't have to remove it every day. If we have days where it's really cold and gloomy, there's nothing particularly wrong with leaving it on there, but every so often it should come off during the daytime and then get put back on as we get towards the end of the afternoon. Bearing in mind that trapping heat requires some direct sun on there. So if you were just using a box with the blanket, the frost material on it, you would want to get that thing back over there, let's say 3 in the afternoon to get an hour of sunlight. But you've taken care of that problem because you have little light bulbs in there. So it doesn't matter quite as much. Putting it on right as we get towards the end of the day, turning the lights on, that would be the best way to manage it.
Okay, will it fry or suffocate the plant? I think
Sure.
you answered that one.
Unlikely, yeah.
And would you recommend a vent hole anywhere?
I don't think that's necessary as long as you take it off every now and then.
Okay, the frost cloth that I used is the hoop cover type.
Yeah, this is
This
a
is a
you.
good suggestion and it looks festive. Thanks for all that you do.
This does. It looks great, and that's something you could put in your front yard and be like a holiday decoration. A
Yeah,
frost
so
cube. I think this is great. Really
it's
simple.
beautiful.
You don't
Beautiful.
absolutely have to do this kind of a structure. We were having a conversation with someone who was putting in a young lime, and we were talking about how, if we get cold, you might want to be prepared to protect it. He's doing a gold medallion tree. This is a tree that basically is hardy in Southern California, maybe coastal California. We don't think it's hardy here in the interior, but it could be once established. And so, as with many woody plants, it's the first winter that's the concern, whether it's a bougainvillea, a young lime tree, gold medallion, something you're growing that you're stretching your zone boundaries a little bit. Covering it the first winter when it's unusually cold wouldn't be a bad plan. The lime, I suggested, just as I try to remember to do when I put a young tree in that's on the tender end of the citrus spectrum, put three or four stakes around it that are slightly taller than the plant. These can be as simple as one by one. You don't need to, go out, make a big heavy duty structure. That way, if you see, oh, it's clearing up at the end of the day and it's late November, December, early January, we're going to get cold tonight. You can go out with a frost blanket and simply drape it over the frame and you'll have a little mini greenhouse that way. I will say that these new frost blanket materials that we've all been selling for a decade or so now are lightweight enough. They don't really do damage to the plant, even at the points of contact. So 20, 30 years ago, when we were talking about frost protection, we'd be saying, you want to cover it with clear plastic or a blanket or something, but don't let there be any points of contact. That's because heavier materials touching the leaves, then getting cold, would injure every place that there was contact. We would get all these points of injury. This stuff doesn't do that. You don't have to worry about that. So if you're really in a hurry, it's the end of the day, and you want to just cover it up somehow, better if you can do it before the sun's gone down, because then you're, gaining the benefit of a little bit of maybe an hour of direct sunlight on it. Just go ahead and drape it over, and it'll trap the heat that's being lost to the sky from the ground, and it will give you 2 to 4 degrees protection. That may be all you need for something like a young citrus or a young bougainvillea. You don't have to worry too much about the points of contact, but it's simpler. You just have a little frame around the new plant, and you can just drape it right over that, staple it on if there's a little wind coming up, or attach it with clothespins or something to hold it in place, and that'll give you a couple to a few degrees of protection. What he's doing, going to give
is so beautiful.
more than just a
It's
couple
so
degrees of
beautiful.
protection. This is like a little mini heated greenhouse, and I think this is phenomenal. So thanks for the picture. We really appreciate this kind of input.
And when you do this, does it matter if it's the tree has leaves or is deciduous?
Well, we wouldn't be worried about deciduous plants. I can't think of any truly deciduous things where we'd have a frost issue. So we were talking about evergreens. Now, we had a funny conversation about this at our store because people who work for me keep referring to subtropical plants that lose their leaves here because of cold weather as being deciduous. And I finally said, we can't really say that because they're not deciduous in the sense of forming an abscission layer and going into a dormancy cycle. They're only deciduous because their leaves are freezing off. That's different. That's cold injury. So these are subtropicals that drop their leaves that are usually evergreen. That's, we don't have a really convenient shorthand for this. So those are usually what we're talking about. Young citrus, young bougainvilleas. If you're trying to overwinter a hibiscus, if you're planting something like a cassia, like a medallion tree that is a little marginal here when it's young. If it's a young jacaranda tree that will eventually be hardy enough but is marginal when it first goes in, that's what we're talking about. Subtropical evergreens that will defoliate if we get colder than is optimal for them. In that category, there are things like lantanas, and people are always worried, it's leaves are blackening. Do I need to do anything? No, don't worry at all about lantanas. They will come back just fine, even though they've completely defoliated. They're not deciduous. They're an evergreen subtropical that got frost damage, but they resprout from buds down closer to the base.
Well, here's another message. This is from Ilya in Tiburon. Hi, Don and Lois. I've been listening to your podcast, and you recently mentioned pruning off branches on loquats affected by fire blight. I've got an apple tree next to a loquat, and both have a few blackened branches. I'm ready to prune off all small branches as my apple tree is about to go dormant, but I noticed this large blackened area, see photo, on one of the two main trunks of the apple tree. Should this whole section go? Please share your thoughts. Thanks in advance.
Before you cut this off, step back about 10 feet and take another picture so I can look at it and we can see whether this is just going to disfigure the tree to the point that it's not manageable or whether you can cut it out and do a little retraining on the tree over the next couple of years. So go ahead and take another picture and send that along. This is a problem with fire blight when you get it on any of these difficult places like the main trunk or down at the graft union, which happens. Fire blight often infects root suckers from the rootstock. We want to prune it out if we possibly can. I'm going to say you probably will need to prune that out, but let's make an informed decision together with another picture. Okay. Normally, it infects through the blossom. So that's pretty easy to prune out that area. Or it infects through the very tender new growth. Well, that's really easy to prune out. Or as I say, root suckers. So, really important thing is as we go into fire blight season, 55 to 82 degrees. Okay. So that's spring when the trees are blooming. Having all the root suckers cut off actually is really important. If you've got a rootstock that tends to sucker heavily, remove all of those so you don't run into that kind of a problem.
Hi, Lois and Don. This is from Emily. I would love to hear your tomato recommendations for a foggy central coast of California. I live half a mile from the ocean and in the fog belt. I have sandy soil, no frost, drip irrigation, and potentially full sun if the fog burns off. I've grown sun gold. I thought they were great, moderately productive here, and a good taste. Should I stick to cherry tomatoes or are larger tomatoes possible? Any varieties, cherry or otherwise, that I should try that might be productive here? Also, I wanted to say thank you for making your radio show available as a podcast. It makes it so much easier for me to listen to. You're welcome, Emily.
My father was an avid tomato gardener on the coast of San Diego, and fog was a normal thing every day of the year, seemingly, except in Christmas time, every day of the year in the summer until about noon or 1 o'clock, and then it would burn off. He tried all kinds of different tomatoes and always settled back into cherry because they did very well. They're extremely vigorous. He liked one called Basket Pack, which was exceptionally vigorous and productive. So, and he also would plant six of them every year, which was kind of unnecessary. But any of the cherry tomatoes would do well for us. Yes, they ripen quickly. They're a little tangier perhaps there than they would be maybe a little sweeter here in the valley with more sunshine, but they do very well. And people expect cherry tomatoes to be tangy. The other one he loved to grow, and so I'll suggest this one, was San Marzano, the classic Italian paste tomato. San Marzano did very, very well for him, and I understand it does well in almost all parts of California. It does very well here in the Sacramento Valley, but this is tomato country. San Marzano is one to look for, and my guess is that paste tomatoes in general would be successful for you. Smaller fruited large fruit types. I know that sounds like a contradiction in terms, but we're getting bigger than cherry and sauce tomatoes. Early Girl and its ilk, 4 to 8 ounce fruit, sometimes bigger. They did well for him. And there are always varieties that are local. So this is the one thing that where you do want to talk to longtime gardeners, master gardeners, your local nursery where there's someone that really knows their tomatoes, because he would go all around San Diego looking for a couple varieties that had been recommended to him by nurseries down there. Walter Anderson Nursery recommended one called Otay Mesa, which is named after a part of San Diego, did very well for him. So there are going to be local varieties anywhere you're listening that are particularly well adapted. And the coastal zones are typically, if you're getting into larger slicing tomatoes, 4 to 8 ounce fruit. I don't think you're going to be successful with the really big 10 and 12 ounce types. Try them, go ahead and give them a try. But that's a lot of space to devote to something that may not produce very much for you, or where the fruit quality might not be where you want it to be. But I would say, in general, the early girl size, the ones that are 4, 6, 8 ounce fruit, are probably going to do well for you. And early fruiting types in general are probably going to be successful. So I'll do some more research on this, ask some of my friends who sell tomatoes in coastal zones which ones they particularly recommend. Once upon a time, for example, one of our growers inadvertently left a flat of a tomato variety at our nursery called San Francisco Fog. We didn't really need that at our nursery. We sold them, and people said they were fine. But that one is particularly popular in, I don't know, Fort Bragg, Bodega Bay, places like that, where it's kind of like what you're describing, foggy all the way into the early afternoon, sometimes all day. People like that in the summer, but it's not so great for the summer vegetables. So there's probably a local variety, and that one in particular, San Francisco Fog, is probably one to look for. But in general, I think you'll do well, obviously, with cherry types, clustered fruiting types. Sauce types are probably going to be good for you. And the smaller of the slicing tomatoes would be my best recommendation for now.
Don always gets these interesting questions. Customers walk in and just say things like, "Can you get me a female ginkgo tree?" Now, my first question to that would be, "Why do you want
Because
one?"
the ginkgo nuts are delicious. The problem is they're surrounded by pulpy stuff that's got butyric acid in it.
Stinks. It
Butyric acid,
stinks.
the definition of the term putrid, it would come from butyric acid. And that's what is in the flesh around the ginkgo nut. But ginkgo nuts, I can tell you, I had a staff person who carefully processed them one time years ago, roasted them, brought them into me. They reminded me of chestnuts. I mean, the flavor was very good. This person went through the trouble of getting that pulpy, disgusting stuff off of them, which is usually done in a bucket of water with dishwashing gloves and all that kind of stuff to keep it off your hands. And inside that, there is a nut that is quite delicious. Believe it or not, I didn't tell this lady this, there is a selected cultivar of Ginkgo biloba that's female. It does exist. So I didn't tell this person that because I knew what the next question would be. Oh,
Can
can you
you
get
get
it?
it?
No, I cannot get it. But I was looking up a bunch of nut information, doing an article on nuts years ago, and I came across a nut nursery up in Canada, Ontario, Canada, that had a female cultivar of ginkgo. So someone grows it for the nuts, and there is a named form, presumably, I don't know, has bigger or better quality ginkgo nuts. That's hard to say. The only way I could say you're likely to get a female ginkgo if you actually really wanted one is to find some seed-grown trees. And by the way, they're very easy to grow from seed. You'll probably find those in the bonsai liner section of a garden center where they sell little seedling trees. We used to sell these little seedling trees for you to make into a bonsai tree. It doesn't mean they have to be made into a bonsai tree. These are just seedling trees. And if they grow ginkgo from seed, it's dioecious. You got male and female trees. You get 50-50, male and female, roughly. And you have to wait 5 to 10 years for them to flower and fruit. That's when you know whether you have a male or a female. Very easy to tell them apart once they do flower because the male flowers are catkins that have pollen on them. They're quite visible. The female flowers are more reduced. And then, of course, the fruit sets. And then you know for a fact that you have female tree. I would suggest you plant this in a place where the fruit falling on the ground won't bother you. And that means not in a lawn because those are the worst areas for them. The ginkgo berry doesn't smell until the skin bursts. So if you're growing it for the ginkgo nut and the fruit is falling or still hanging on the tree and you pick them up off the ground or off the tree very carefully, they won't smell bad. It's when they split that they start to smell bad. So if they're in your lawn, someone mows the lawn, they're splitting all the fruit that's on the ground. And all of a sudden it smells ghastly. It smells just like dog manure, basically. And the high likelihood you'll decide to take the tree out. But if those ginkgo berries can fall to a bark area or a ground cover you don't care about, then it wouldn't be as much of an issue. So there are places where I suppose a female ginkgo tree would be suitable, but bear in mind that odor is almost always causes people to remove the trees as soon as they fruit, if they possibly can. And there's nothing that will prevent the fruit. City of Washington, D.C., 30 to 35,000 ginkgo trees were planted there decades ago from seed. So half of them are female. They've tried all kinds of things to prevent the fruit on them. I don't think any of those things have been successful, though. It's a beautiful tree. Obviously, we always sell only the male cultivars, but if you really want a female, you'll have to do a seedling-grown tree. There's a myth that's out there that the male trees can revert to female. I had encountered this one 20, 30 years ago. Even seemingly authoritative people were saying, no, there's cases where they've reverted. And there were a couple cases that were pointed out. One is some remarkable ginkgo trees, male trees that are in Buddhist monastery, I think it is in Japan. And I'm going off my memory here, so I'd have to look up the actual site. And they have little spurs on them that fruit, a couple of little spurs. And this was considered so important and significant. These trees are protected. In fact, getting in to see them by, Western scientists was very challenging, but they exist. They have little female sort of mutant spurs on otherwise male trees. So that did happen. That's this is what you might call the exception that proves the rule. The other was a case of a big old tree in a garden in one of the royal gardens in the UK, planted in the 18th century. One branch suddenly fruited or had been fruiting. Oh, look, that branch has reverted. Well, probably not. There was a little trend in the 19th century when ginkgos and other trees imported from China were being planted in big numbers. I mean, and also trees from California, sequoia dendron, things like that were being planted all over the UK. And they realized that if they wanted a seed source, they were going to have to provide their own because it was fairly challenging to import things from China in the 19th and 18th centuries.
They
So
grafted
they
one branch.
grafted, this is what we're told, they grafted a branch onto an existing tree. And that is very likely why that branch is female. The other were cases like a University of Wisconsin or Michigan or something where a tree that had been planted as a male was now fully female. No, that was a tree that was mislabeled. I can answer that question. I'm in the nursery business. I know how exactly how that happened. So that was a tree that was female from the start. Or this is a more common one. All the male cultivars that we sell are grafted. So they're
And the
grafted.
rootstock could have been either
They're
one.
grafted onto seedling rootstock, which is 50-50 male, female. No, nobody knows or cares. It's not a clonally propagated rootstock. It's a seed-grown rootstock. And either somewhere in the production process, the grafted part failed, the scion failed, and someone just staked up the rootstock either intentionally or by accident. Now you have rootstock trained into a tree, labeled as if it were male. 50-50 chance. So some of them turn out to be female. Or what has happened three times at my nursery alone, little tiny garden center in Northern California. 15-gallon ginkgo has come in, where someone in tying up the tree to the central nursery stake has inadvertently tied a root sucker against the main trunk tightly enough that it would graft itself if it were retained in that position. And this happened three times from the same wholesaler, by the way, the one who does my very best quality ginkgos. They just happen to not be monitoring the staff as they're doing the staking part, which is done, you know, 100, 200, 300 trees at a time. And they've inadvertently tied root sucker against the main trunk. I know what will happen. It will graft itself on. That part of the tree will be rootstock, and 50-50 chance that that part of the tree will be female. So when you have one side of the tree that's female, it's almost certainly from the rootstock. When you have a whole tree that's female, was labeled as a male, probably the scion failed or the nursery was dishonest, which happens sometimes as well.
The holidays are coming up.
Yes.
And there are holiday plants that people think are toxic, some of which are, some of which aren't, a lot of which aren't. And so Don handed me this article. It's at the National Library of Medicine. And this article is Holiday Plants with Toxic Misconception.
So let's talk about poinsettias. I will quote from them. Despite a longstanding belief in the legend of poinsettia toxicity, there is little data to support this. The toxic reputation stems from a single unconfirmed death of a two-year-old in Hawaii in 1919. Unconfirmed. So bear in mind that it does contain a latex. And if you're allergic to latex, you may well be allergic to the latex that's in euphorbia because it's a similar protein. So if you have a latex allergy, you might be sensitive to the latex in poinsettias. Other than that, ingesting it is not an issue. Poinsettias are not poisonous. It's not that there is some lethal dose and you can't get there. There is no known lethal dose. You can't eat enough leaves to achieve a lethal dose if there were one. So the exposures that people usually have are people biting into a leaf. They taste horrible, by the way, I'm told. I haven't bothered to test that myself because Paul Ecce of Ecce Ranch, the promoters of poinsettias from time immemorial, the people who introduced all the varieties that you have, used to go on TV shows in the San Diego area, and he would take a leaf and eat it on television to demonstrate, one, it tastes terrible, two, he's not going to die on the air. So that, well, not exactly a scientific study. It did illustrate, one, it's hard to ingest, two, don't worry about it. So anytime they tried animal studies, they found, quote, little to no toxicity. However, holly berries contain saponins. Saponins are poisonous. Leaves are not toxic, but the berries do contain a toxin. So be aware of that. It'll be hard to ingest a lot of it, but there are cases in the medical journals of someone ingesting a surprising number and promptly basically throwing them up. Mistletoe. Some forms of mistletoe are toxic and some forms are not. So just assume that it is. And the best bet for that, since the toxic exposures typically are to the berries falling on the floor from a spray of mistletoe hanging above the doorway. And if you just wrap that in some cheesecloth or something, there'll be no risk of the berry falling on the ground and causing any toxicity. And there are some reports of fatalities from mistletoe ingestion of a particular type. It's not the kind we normally have here, but it's something to be aware of because I can't tell you exactly where the mistletoe you bought somewhere came from. So be aware that mistletoe is, it can be a concern. Christmas cactus, Thanksgiving cactus, Easter cactus, all basically the same genus, different species and hybrids, are not toxic. Someone did ask me the other day about cyclamen, since all of us sell a lot of cyclamen at this time of year. Yes, cyclamen do have a toxicity. So you should be a little bit concerned perhaps about pets being exposed to them if you've brought them indoors. Not highly toxic, but there's a toxic compound in them.
You mean when those squirrels come and eat my cyclamen leaves, they might die?
Seems very unlikely. Cyclamen, there was a question, and so we go to the ASPCA list. I'm not thrilled about it because it's binary. It is, they are or are not. They don't give you, you know, nuance. I think North Carolina Extension has a much better list as far as that goes. But since I know most people refer to the ASPCA list, that's what we use at our nursery when we check something. And it did indicate cyclamen is toxic to cats and dogs. So be aware of that one. Poinsettias are not poisonous. They're also not edible, but they're not poisonous. Okay.
November 27th, 2025. Hey, that's Thanksgiving.
Indeed.
I am so thankful that this show has been going for so long and that I get to talk with you every week about garden stuff. So thank you, Don.
And you know what? 20 years ago, for the Davis Enterprise, November 24th, 2005, I wrote an article called "The Edible Plants of Thanksgiving." You can
Ooh.
go to redwoodbarn.com and it gives you information about the things that are on your, well, it depends on where you're from. So I should back up here. My grandmother was from Boston. She was a Boston cook. She cooked the exact same menu for Thanksgiving and Christmas every year. No matter what you suggested, you got the exact same menu. And most people from that region or from the Mid-Atlantic or from the upper Midwest could probably recite the menu.
And what was the menu, Don?
Well, you started with vegetable sticks and olives, and then you had cranberries in one form or another, some sort of cranberry sauce, and there was something with potatoes, like regular potatoes, usually mashed, and then there was something with sweet potatoes, which my grandmother called yams, and there would be boiled onions, and there would be stuffing, which was made from bread cubes. That's the only kind of stuffing grandma would ever make, seasoned with sage, which is the classic seasoning for Boston stuffing, which she called dressing. For those of you from that region, you know that that's what they call it. And dessert, of course, was pecan pie and pumpkin pie. And for my grandfather, she always made a mince pie. And there was also always fruit cake, which had citron in it. So those were some of the things we talked about at the dining table for Thanksgiving and Christmas. I remember when someone once said to grandma, "Maybe this year we should have ham for Christmas." And her answer was, "Ham and turkey? Why would you do that? Seems like a lot of food." So we realized
But
we were
Don,
making.
you didn't say that there was, what was the meat for Thanksgiving?
Of course, it's turkey. That's the only
Well,
kind of
you
meat
didn't say
grandma. That's the only kind of meat grandmother would ever cook. Any suggestion for otherwise was just beyond the pale. She wasn't going to do that. I had a customer years ago who was from the Carolinas, and she also had family in Haiti. And she was here in Davis getting an advanced degree. She was here for about 7 years, and she was a very avid gardener. And fun to talk to her because her food traditions were very different. And she came in and she wanted to grow. She was telling us at the beginning of the summer season, she wanted to grow as much of the Thanksgiving dinner as possible, including the turkey or ham. She was just going to do all the other stuff. Turkeys, yeah, you're on your own. But with respect to the other things, I said, okay, well, I just need to know what that is, because she wanted rice, for example. Her turkey was stuffed with rice. She wanted Carolina rice, which is a particular strain that's grown in the Carolinas. Well, all right, we got the seed, we found a source, she grew it, and she had fun trying to grow these different things. Now, I can tell you that some of them were more challenging. It's hard in your own yard to grow enough rice for a meal like this. That's a more of a farm crop. But the sweet potatoes, or what my grandmother called yams, and the regular potatoes, yep, you can grow those. You can grow the carrots for the carrot sticks. You can grow the celery for the celery sticks. You can grow the olives if you're so inclined, but
But it takes a long time.
the ones you harvested this year will probably be on your Thanksgiving table next year, because you've still got them soaking in lye in the in the garage. It's a fairly tedious process to get them ready for the
And
table.
if she's only here for 7 years, the olive tree isn't going to get very big in
Yeah,
7 years.
would have just been coming into production about the time she got her degree and moved away. And there's a couple things on this list that would be challenging, but let's go through this. So carrot sticks, well, carrots are easy to grow. They actually are as long as you have fast draining soil, real even moisture. They're best planted in the fall or early winter for spring harvest, but you could do them in midsummer and keep them watered. This is really the key. I mean, carrots need a lot of even moisture and loose soil. So they're great for a raised planter that has a micro spray system or something like that. If you have drippers, make sure the plant is like right on the dripper. And you'd be harvesting those for Thanksgiving. And they'll be very sweet if we've had anything close to a frost at the time you harvest. That sweetens up the root vegetables. Celery. I have grown celery many times myself. I'm looking out the window and I have a planter full of celery. The thing to be aware of is that celery you grow yourself will be very strong flavored. To get that sweet, tender celery that you buy in the store, here's today's vocabulary word: they etiolate the stems.
What? What?
Etiolate the stems. Etiolate is a process of excluding sun from the portion of the plant that you want to have more sweet and tender. It's done with rhubarb, it's done with asparagus, it's done with celery as a standard matter where you just bury the stem somehow or cover it somehow to make it less green, sweeter, more tender. We don't do that with the celery. We grow in our own garden, so we have something that tastes more like giant parsley, but it is very flavorful. It's great for cooking, and it is surprisingly easy to grow celery. I'm looking at a half barrel that I stuck a six pack of celery into a year and a half ago, and it's flourishing. It's doing great. It's obviously rooted into the ground below, and I've been able to cut little pieces off of that for cooking almost any time. But yes, you can grow your own celery sticks. We mentioned olives. Yes, olives are very easy to grow. I mean, they're a tree that's extremely heat tolerant, extremely drought tolerant. Processing them may be something more than you want to get into, but it's worth looking into if you decide to go in that direction. Look for varieties that are for that purpose. Some of them are more for oil, some of them are more for processing into olives, some are dual purpose. If you're interested in that, I have a whole chart that I send out to people when they inquire about it. If you really get into olives, just send a note to davisgardenshow@gmail.com. I'll send you my spreadsheet on olive varieties so you can choose between oil types, curing types, dual purpose, ones that are very tender, ones that are very, very large, and so forth. But
And
the
the
two,
fruitless ones.
and the fruitless, the quote unquote fruitless ones,
Yes.
yes. If you just want to make an easy choice, Mission and Manzanillo are the two olive varieties that are historic varieties here in California. Both of them do very well here. But again, it's more work than most people want to do. Easy to do, but time consuming. Cranberries. Well,
Not
this
really.
isn't really cranberry country. The most common species, there's actually more than one, Vaccinium macrocarpon, is from northeastern US and Canada. So, about as dissimilar from our climate here in the Sacramento Valley as you can get. It's in the heather family. So, if I
It's
were,
related to blueberries.
yeah, and they all are plants from places that have consistent moisture. They generally have low pH, more acidic soils. What they really have in most cases is really important soil mycorrhizae that are kind of unique to them, that enable them to take up micronutrients in soils that are typically deficient in micronutrients. So they're really good at extracting nutrients from soils that are relatively low in those things. The problem with plants that do that is if you put them in soils that have a lot of nutrients or minerals in particular, they'll burn really badly. And so we have this problem with blueberries, for example, until we realize that they just need a lot more organic material on the surface. If I were going to grow cranberries here, I'm not going to take this on. You know what? Maybe I will. But I would put them in a big planter. I wouldn't put them in the open soil here. And I would fill that planter with a mix of something like sand and pine bark. Now, that's not something you're going to find locally. Pine bark in California, not real common. But if you're listening in the southeastern United States, I'm told it's one of the most common things you can find at garden centers because it's everywhere down there. So I would do something like that, some kind of barkish material with some compost and some sand. I'd probably put some sulfur in just to try and bring the pH down, although that's probably not that critical. I'd put them in with a watering system that's going to come on like every single day, and I would mulch the heck out of them, and I would wonder why I'm doing this. But do that kind of thing for fun. Why not? If any of you are growing cranberries successfully, especially in the arid West, please let us know what your technique is.
I think, Don, that you should get one of those cattle barrels,
Yeah, livestock trough. Yeah.
livestock trough. Yes, that's
Yes.
the official name. And then make the soil level fairly low, plant your plants. Then, when you go to harvest them, stick the plug back in and fill it up with water so that you can go out there and shake your bushes and have the cranberries floating in a certain level of the surface. That is not how you need to harvest them, but boy, it is sure looks like fun.
Yeah, I've almost thought that you had to grow them in bogs, and my
No,
understanding is
they don't grow in a bog.
no.
They are the fields are flooded when it's time to harvest them
Yeah, and
so
then
that the
they.
berries float up.
As I said here on my article, grown in bogs for ease of harvest, just beat the bushes, float off the berries, and that's all they're doing it for. And
So how about, I think, let's try this one. The sage that you're going to put
there
into
you
the
go.
dressing.
Yeah.
So you have bread cubes and sage and some oil and
Yeah, that's your basic
roasted up.
American stuffing or New England stuffing anyway. And as I say, my grandmother
Dressing
called
done,
it,
not
she called
stuffing.
it dressing. Yes. Sage, common garden sage is the active ingredient that flavors it so nicely. And in fact, it's probably one of the only uses most people have for kitchen sage is their Thanksgiving and Christmas stuffing for their birds. Sage is really easy to grow. As with everything in the genus Salvia, almost all of them love our conditions here, the very sunny, dry, hot conditions that we have. If you want to plant a garden sage plant, give it at least 3 feet of space. It's a shrub. They get about 3 to 4 feet across, as much as 3 feet tall. The foliage is very attractive. There are some forms that have even more attractive foliage with more purple leaves or golden variegated leaves. They've all got the same aroma and flavor constituents, so it doesn't really matter which of these common garden sages you buy, which cultivar. But Salvia officinalis is very easy to grow, and it's a really good plant for a low water landscape. So it can go in with some of our natives, Mediterranean plants, which is what it is, and can be essentially unirrigated once established or very, very low irrigation. So that's an easy one. The potatoes and the sweet potatoes are easy to grow. The timing might be a little challenging on the potatoes because we plant them here February to March, and we're harvesting in the early summer. I do have customers who plant in the late spring, early summer, and are harvesting in the late summer, early fall. They're getting what we call new potatoes, the smaller potatoes, because the plant simply doesn't produce as big a potato when you do it that way. That would be your kind of classic Thanksgiving table potatoes. And I had an organic farmer years ago who told me that she planted potatoes in July for the Thanksgiving market. Again, new potatoes is what you're growing them for, the smaller potatoes that you're just either going to boil whole or perhaps mash. But they were very easy. They just need, as with all root vegetables, reasonably loose soil so they'll develop without being all lumpy and weird, and pretty even moisture in the early stages of development. And then you have to figure out how you taper off on the irrigation. Of the whole group, the sweet potatoes are surprisingly easy to grow. I've done them a few times. Usually you get more than you know what to do with. It's a vigorous vine. I don't even bring them in to sell them at my nursery until May. They're almost tropical and they want to go into very warm soil. They grow very fast. They're a vine, so you want something for them to climb on. If you don't, they'll run all over across the ground. More typically, my customers will plant them in a bed with loose soil. Again, you want soil that the roots can expand in without becoming all disfigured. So it should be reasonably loose. So this is a case where you do typically amend them. They need real even moisture while they're getting going, and they're a very vigorous vine. So put them on at least a short fence of some kind. I find tomato cages work great for keeping them more or less in one place. They grow all summer long. You wonder when you're ever going to be harvesting. About October, you start poking around down there, realize, oh, hey, look, there's a whole bunch of these things down here. Sometime September, October, November, you're typically going to dig them, and they store just great. And not a difficult place here in the Sacramento Valley to grow sweet potatoes at all. What my grandmother was calling yams are not yams. This will be a subject of debate, I'm sure, at the Thanksgiving table. So let's see if we can settle this for you right now. What she was calling yams are officially called garnet yams. The USDA, even years ago, said you can call these garnet yams, but they're not yams. They're garnet yams. They're sweet potatoes. They're just red-skinned sweet potatoes, whereas the tan or lighter pink-skinned ones are called sweet potatoes. Same plant, different variety. A yam is a different thing. A true yam is a tropical plant. It also makes a starchy root. You don't very commonly see true yams in any grocery stores in California, but you will find them at specialty markets or grocery stores that have a significant ethnic population, people from various parts of Asia or tropics, Africa, and so forth, where they're buying them. It is used sort of like a potato or a sweet potato, but it's a totally different plant. And it's totally tender here. Now, some of the things that are added to stuffing or dressing include filberts and pine nuts, both of which are very good. Filberts, I get this question periodically. We have a native filbert in California, not here in the valley, native up in the mountains. And people ask if they can grow filberts. And I have never heard of anyone in this area successfully growing and getting filberts from their filberts. They grow, but they don't produce well here. It's a small tree. They're grown up in Oregon. That's where most of the filberts, hazelnuts in the US come from. And they're not tolerant of hot, dry climates. They burn really badly here, whether it's the ornamental one, the Harry Lauder's walking stick, or the filberts that are grown for the nuts. It's simply not something I'm going to recommend here. I know Capital Nursery sold them for years and years. I knew the buyer there. They finally decided to stop selling them because people would plant them. They'd wait 10, 15, 20 years and things would never produce for them, in spite of having the right cross-pollination and all that kind of thing. So listening here in the Central Valley of California, I'm going to say filberts aren't going to do well for you. Give them a try, but mostly you're going to be up in the Pacific Northwest.
Now, filberts are also called hazelnuts, aren't they? Okay. See, that's another regional thing. I've
Yes,
never
indeed.
heard of filberts, but I knew hazelnuts.
And the other would be pine nuts. And there's a
Yeah.
number of species of pines that do produce pine nuts, Pinus monophylla, Pinus edulis. These are the pinions that are grown in the South, well, grown, that grow native in the American Southwest. Very slow growing trees. They grow, ooh, 6 to 12 inches a year. They're mostly wild harvested down there in New Mexico, Arizona, places like that. Yes, you could grow a pinion nut tree here if you were so inclined. I have one in a 2 gallon container I've had for 4 years, and it's 2 feet tall. So, you're not going to be harvesting these anytime soon. But there's a bunch of other species that do produce nuts. I gather that the nuts of almost any pine are technically edible, but the ones that are really grown for their flavor and their quality are Pinus monophylla and Pinus edulis, which are native trees in the American Southwest. But the nut that we really want for Thanksgiving and Christmas is the pecan. And that, well, yes, they're easy to grow. But walnuts and pecans are very similar. A lot of people would have difficulty telling the trees apart. So if you're thinking of a pecan for your backyard, one, you need to choose one that's self-fruitful. So you'd get Western Schley, which is a very good quality pecan that will produce without having another one nearby. Two, it's a very big tree. Mine that I'm looking at out this window is at least 60 feet tall. It was planted about 80 years ago, so it took a while to get that big, but it's a big tree with the look of a walnut, but more upright, but still a big canopy. The main thing about pecans, aside from the fact that they need careful training because they have a tendency to narrow branch angles. So, in establishing my orchard, I was watching for that and trying to prune out those branches as the trees went along. They need some careful training, but the main issue is they always get aphids. Your pecan tree will get aphids and it'll be sticky and drippy underneath the tree. There's really nothing to do about that. You don't really want to do anything about that. I don't want you treating your pecan tree with a systemic insecticide,
Ew.
even if you could get one, which you can't in California anyway. So you have to be aware that it's going to be kind of sticky underneath a pecan tree. This is not a tree I would put in your front yard as a shade tree or your backyard where you're going to have activities because of the sticky residue underneath the tree. It doesn't hurt them, but it is something to be aware of, that pecans are very big trees, narrow branch angles, and the aphid problem can be an issue. I have found them amazingly drought tolerant. Well, they come from the southeastern United States. They're native back there and into the eastern part of Texas. The biggest pecan-producing state in the U.S. is Arizona, where they turned out to be extremely well adapted. They weren't native there, to my knowledge, but they planted there, and there's big operations down there. As long as they have plenty of water and getting established, they do very well. And for home gardeners, they don't even really need plenty of water once established. They're surprisingly drought tolerant. I should mention that, like walnuts, pecan trees reseed quite a bit. However, they do quite well. I have lots of pecans here. And what's the other pie that we eat for Thanksgiving?
Pumpkin pie.
Pumpkin pie. And now to resolve another debate at the Thanksgiving table, the pumpkin pie you're eating, it was made with pumpkin, quote unquote, from a can. That's actually a hybrid squash. It's actually not technically a pumpkin. You can, however, grow pie pumpkins quite easily, and I do every year. Probably the best, in my opinion, is a variety called sugar or pie. It's an heirloom variety that's been around for at least a couple hundred years. Small fruited one, they're maybe 6 or 8 inches across, very dense and meaty, and really easy to prepare. You just cut them in half, scoop out the seeds, flip them up face down onto a cookie sheet, and roast them until everything inside has gotten soft and squishy, and then you can make your pie out of it. Very easy to do, but most people buy their pumpkin pie filling in cans, in which case they're not actually buying pumpkin. They're buying hybrid squash. Pumpkins, plant them about anywhere June 1 to July 1. You'll be harvesting in October. And of course, pumpkins store beautifully for this kind of purpose. The other thing that you use a lot of in all of your cooking in Thanksgiving and Christmas is sugar. Can you grow your own sugar? Well, so you can grow sugar cane if you're truly in the tropics or the subtropics. Sugar cane is a plant, it's a grass. It gets about as big as pampas grass. All right, so very large grass. And I should mention that it has kind of hairs on the stem and sharp edges on the leaf. Saccharum officinarum is the sugar cane that's grown in tropical regions in places like Hawaii. That isn't the kind of sugar we grew here in the valley when I moved here. That was sugar beets.
Yep. Yeah.
They were a big crop in the Sacramento Valley when I moved to this area in the 1970s. It's a giant beet, and it's about 12 to 20% sugar content. So interesting to do, but again, not something you're likely to do to make your own sugar. Or that's where sugar comes from, sugar cane or sugar beets. Sugar cane, tropical to subtropical. Sugar beets can be grown here in the valley if you're inclined. Now, the one that came up at our Thanksgiving table was citron. And I remember my grandfather and my father arguing about this. A polite argument, but they were having a factual argument. In the old days, you couldn't pull out your phone and look up the answer. You couldn't go to a computer. There were no computers and look up the answer. Someone had to go upstairs to the Encyclopedia Britannica and find the answer there. Citron is the chewy stuff in your fruitcake. It's citron. It's a candied fruit. And my grandfather said, it's a citrus. My father said, no, no, it's a melon. Pausing, well, so you all can debate this for a moment.
Okay, the answer is citron, C-I-T-R-O-N, isn't that the process of making this thing?
No, it's a whole category of citrus. And the Etrog citron, for example, is real important in the Passover meal. The Buddha's hand citron that you see at grocery stores right now, that really funny citrus that has the weird finger-like things on it, that's a citron. It's basically a citrus where it's mostly peel. Inside there is a little tiny fruit that's a lemon. It's essentially like a lemon. And that part is edible, but it's grown for the thick, spongy peel and the part under the peel. And that has traditionally been taken, and this is from the citrus version, and boiled in a sugar solution until it's suffused with the sugar solution and then dried. And when you do that, it's a candied peel, basically candied chunks of citrus peel. Long ago, it was discovered that there was a melon to have very much the same texture. So citron is citrus, medica is the old name. Citron melon is citrullus vulgaris. It's a true melon, like a watermelon. It's from North Africa, and they found that they could take that and slice it and put it in a sugar solution and cook it until it was suffused with the sugar and then dry it. And the process is called candying. And that is far more commonly used in fruitcake than the citron that comes from citrus. Both are called citron. Granddaddy and my father were both correct, as my brother discovered when he was sent upstairs to the encyclopedia to find the answer. He came down with a big grin and said, "You're both right." And we all gave thanks for that.
Well, we usually end our show with a garden quote, and let's see if I can find a good one today. Ah, here we go. This is from one of Don's articles. Wonderful food can come from the garden or be eaten right out there.
Sure.
Have Thanksgiving by noshing in your garden. Why not?
There you go. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.